The Coin Week podcast is brought to you by PCGS. To see this quarter's grading specials, go to their website at www.pcgs.com. In this episode of the Coin Week podcast, I talk to Joe Minna, Chief Engraver of the United States Mint. Joe has devoted practically his entire life to art, and now, as the main art director at the Mint, he gets to bring that lifetime of thought and devotion to bear on a task that is both an exciting personal opportunity and something bigger than himself, the creation of a national coinage that we can all be proud of. A task that Joe takes very much to heart. To a collector, there is much to be learned here about recent Mint history, how the Mint works behind the scenes, and what being the chief engraver, a position officially revived after almost 40 years, entails in the 21st century. To an artist, there's also a lot that can be learned from Joe's open and earnest discussion about his experiences as both a student and a professional artist, as well as his thoughts and feelings on art itself. From Jose Luis Garcia Lopez to Van Gogh, he is not afraid to mix the low and the high, the popular and the fine. We talk about all this and more next on the Coin Week podcast. Well, Joe, thank you for joining us on the Coin Week podcast. We're so delighted to have you today. And I have some great questions I think I've prepared, but I'm pretty sure we're going to go in all sorts of different tangents. I'd like to start and ask you how did you get your start as an artist? I mean, was this something that came naturally to you as a youngster, or did you really work to cultivate it?
Always drew ever since my earliest memories, and I recounted this story once long ago, as I had the good fortune of being featured in a profile that one of my freelance clients did, a very high level production profile. But the story in it is true. I was ill when I was a kid, and I was in the hospital for a couple of days. I was like 18 months old. And my mom recounts me drawing even back then, like, you know, picking up crayons and stuff. And I've always drawn. I never thought about anything else other than being an artist.
Did it come naturally to you? Did you think you were good at it, or did you become good at it over time and with training?
Well, no, I mean, when you're a kid, let's just say, you know, I never thought about being good. I just thought about it was something I loved to do. I loved drawing my heroes, whether it was Evel Knievel or $6 Million Man. I don't think it's a secret among my friends or on social media or at the Mint. I'm a big fan of comics. Comics really accelerated my interest in drawing, because I used to make my own comics. I used to copy comics. That's how I learned to read, by reading. I mean, I was reading very early because of my love of comics. And plus, you know, my mother was a school teacher. My father was a law student way back then. So, you know, reading was always an imperative in my house. My brother's 2 years younger than me, but I picked up reading very early, and comics helped facilitate my love of art. I remember copying. My grandfather made a special room in my grandma and my grandpa's house. We had a little playroom for my brother and myself. And my grandmother was a school teacher, so she was able to get a desk. And my grandpa sawed the legs off it, so it was like, you know, small enough for a 3 or 4 year old. And I remember even the very cover of a comic that I was copying by an artist named Jose Luis Garcia Lopez. Great. He's a great master. And my grandfather started saying, like, hey, why don't you take this logo and move it over here? Why don't you? My grandfather's always like trying to encourage me to make stuff my own. He was really special that way. He was special in every way. He was my best friend to this day, best friend I ever had. He died when I was 11. But he would be the kind of guy who'd be like, hey, you know, if you design a car, I'll send it to Chrysler. Or if you do, you know, he more than anybody really was my grandmom too. And both sets of grandparents and my parents, everybody always encouraged me. School was a little different. Like kindergarten, like I had a dream. You know, we all grew up. I'm a little older than you, I think. I grew up watching the Adam West Batman series. I had a dream that I was in the car with Batman and Robin, right? Except for some reason, Burt Ward was wearing Fruit of the Looms and not his green shorts. So we had an assignment in kindergarten to draw your dream. So I drew my dream, and my teacher didn't, like, knowing I was a comic kid, she didn't believe me, and she failed me, and she really discouraged me a lot. And then I had a lot of further going forward all through school. I had a lot of really encouraging teachers. I switched to Catholic school my freshman year, and the nun, Sister Elvira, told me I'd never be an artist, told me everything I did was contrary to what real art was. She's doing like little still lifes of apples, and you know, I'm painting like people surfing or doing this or doing that, and just stuff a normal 15-year-old would paint, right? But then I had a high school art teacher, and when I switched to public school, and she got me really involved in, she tried to really foster my development. She had me signing up for like Saturday classes at local colleges. She got me involved in the New Jersey State Arts Council Teen Arts program and annual competitions and entering my work. She got me involved in going to a summer arts camp that was held at, it wasn't Rutgers, it was New Jersey Arts Council, but it was held at Rutgers. It's like Governor's School for Artists. And I really started to really expand. I mean, my love of art was informed by comics throughout my entire youth and teenage years. But when I was 17 at this art camp, I saw Kirk Douglas's performance of Vincent van Gogh in Lust for Life. And even though it was dramatized and sentimentalized and romantic, the pure power of Kirk Douglas's performance, I just started crying. And it changed my life right then and there. And to this day, I mean, I keep Van Gogh's letters with me. He's my favorite anything, my favorite artist of all time. I've never been to Amsterdam, but I've seen his work at the Musée d'Orsay in Paris. I've seen it here in Philadelphia. I've seen it in New York. I've seen it all over. And that really changed my vector towards wanting to become a fine artist. So at the time, like a lot of New York gallery painters were famous, like Julian Schnabel and guys like that. Or in Germany, Anselm Kiefer. So I was trying to become like a gallery painter. That was my thing, right? I wanted to be like a gallery painter. So I necessarily had to go, I needed to go to art school by scholarship. So I got accepted to different schools. My school of choice was Pratt, but they didn't give me enough money. I got a full scholarship for the first year of University of Arts, and I went there. I joined the painting department. It was so, the painting department was so, to me at that time, horrifying that I switched to the sculpture department. Because when I walked around the sculpture department, it wasn't that it was classical or anything, but it was very structured. There was a lot of structure to the work. It was either constructivist or architectonic, and it was interesting. And some figurative work. I'm not a fan of figurative work now. I'm a fan of all types of art from around the world and all different styles. But at the time, I felt that learning the figure would be my best way to, because it wasn't popular back then, back in 1989. But it became a way for me to learn how to develop my skills. And I met this gentleman, Ukrainian gentleman, who studied in Russia. He sculpted and drew better than anyone I had met in my life. The figurative tradition never really took root here in America. It was, and any of the exponents that were strong with it, like Sanok or Wyman or Augustus St. Gaudens, like, these guys all studied in Europe, you know, like they're training abroad in Pennsylvania Academy. Philadelphia is the heart of the artistic tradition in the United States. It got superseded by New York when, you know, a lot of expatriate artists from Europe fled here in the early 20th century. You know, geniuses like Picasso and whoever, they, you know, it changed the world. I don't know if Picasso in particular came here, but I'm just saying. But it was just like. So anyway, this guy, he didn't do any figure of art himself. He did his really, for what I thought was wildly inventive and expressive work. But he said, you have to learn your found, you have to learn your found, you have to build your wings before you can fly. And so he said, he advocated a traditional education like he had. So I studied with him for 2 years in Philadelphia. I went to the New York Academy in Manhattan exclusively, also by scholarship exclusively, so I could study with him while he was in, because he was from Brooklyn, but he taught at a school in Manhattan. And then my fellow former Medallic artist and best friend of 34 years, Mike Gaudioso, and I, this is parallel. Mike Gaudioso and I met freshman year of college, and we decided that we were going to do this thing together. So we were on this mission to like become just like master artists, whatever that meant. And so after I finished grad school, I worked as a waiter for 2 years, continued to study with this guy. His name is Leonid Lerman. And Mike Gaudioso worked as well as a waiter. And I had some personal entanglements that kept me from leaving when he did. He went to Russia a year before I did, but I went and joined him. He went to a school called the Rapin Institute, which would be the equivalent of the Pennsylvania Academy in the old days. And I went to a school called Steiglitz, which used to be called the Mukina Institute, and it was more of the industrial design school, like the school for monuments and public art and stuff like that. And in Russia, I learned we didn't study just Greco-Roman traditional stuff. We looked at all the best, the way I can encapsulate it best is the kind of things that Henry Moore described sculpture as being. There's a book called Henry Moore on Sculpture, and he never wrote anything down about sculpture, but he did a lot of interviews and gave a lot of speeches. And that collection in that book really encapsulates the way I was taught sculpture in Russia. And we looked at all the world's great sculpture traditions, whether they were Mesoamerican, you know, Asian, Pan-African. It really horrifies me when people separate Egyptian sculpture and art from African art, because it is African. You know, work of indigenous peoples from around the world, Greek and Roman art, you know, Socratic art, Etruscan art, Romanesque art was a big favorite of mine, Romanesque art and art, sculpture and architecture. And we tried to distill what was it that all these things had in common, and that's how we, that was our definition of classical sculpture at this school in Russia, of all places. It wasn't what people think. It wasn't like a social realist, you know, like training school. It was a very, yeah, very, they just at that time, it was a very, very deep and profound way of understanding, a very, you know, just the way you, if you recall the how good the ballet dancers from Russia were, or the, you know, the classical musicians, or even the athletes, the level of art instruction was equally intense back then, and elevated to a level that I don't think it's ever reached here. And that's not a bad thing, because I think one of the reasons that this stuff never really, see, this tradition is survived in Russia because for the totalitarian society promoted itself propagandistically, it needed a vehicle for people to readily understand their propaganda. So that's why they had social realism in. And they carried the tradition directly from the French Academy forward. Whereas here, where it's a democracy, right? And the democracy necessarily anything goes. So the tradition never really took root here, because we're a tradition of all traditions, especially in the latter 20th century. So not trying to say one's better or worse, you know, it's just like, I know I'm going off on a crazy tangent, but everything I am and did and learned about art came from the school in Russia. It was sculpting relief I learned how to do in Russia. Everything I, yeah.
It seems interesting to me there. I mean, it seems like your sort of your formative years in American public schools and then Catholic school, like the instruction surrounding art was more sort of judgmental of your output or your motive or the things that you're excited by. And then you go to this very rigid, very formal, formal school, I guess, in Russia. I don't know. I mean, if, I don't know if you speak Russian or not, but that it seems
yeah,
like
I do.
Yeah, yeah. So it seems like it would have been Ochen Trudno to be in Russia, like in this environment, without the cultural sort of the connection, the direct cultural connection, and then. But you had a much better experience, and it was more transformative to your development.
The first time I visited Russia on a scouting mission, it was the March before I went in September. It was the first time I really left the country outside of Canada. But St. Petersburg is like this Hans Christian Andersen fairy tale city on the edge of the world. It's just such, unlike other European cities that grew over an accretion, almost like barnacles and sandcastles, different architectural styles over the centuries and even millennia. St. Petersburg was crafted by a monster, St. Peter the Great, but arguably a monster, but it was conceived all at once as one fell swoop. The entire city is like a monument that you come around the corner, you're supposed to see this. The whole thing is designed to be one aesthetic experience. He imported all these Italian artists and architects and everything. And, you know, he wanted to make it look like the Venice of the North. So instead of the marble, they would paint the stucco and concrete, the colors of the different marbles in Venice and stuff. But the thing about Russia is I went there in 96, right? So you're only a couple years after the revolution. It was a completely different, I can't editorialize on anything now. You have to understand, I got married in Russia. My daughter was born in Russia. My wife's family is equally my family. My Ukrainian brother, and I went to school with, at the time it was very much like Ukrainian, Moldovan, people from Uzbekistan, Kazakhstan, Armenia, Siberia. It was a very cosmopolitan, international collection of former Soviet republics, like students. So like when this thing all started last year, you know, my Ukrainian buddies are showing me FaceTime videos with stuff going on in real time. And I do some volunteer work trying to support the kids over there, children. This is, and then my family, you know, it's just difficult on my family. My wife and I have been married. We've been together. I met her November 19th, 26 years ago. My daughter is now a public defender for the state of New Jersey. She was born in Russia, and that was a whole nother thing. She was born ill, and that was really difficult to manage. We came home after she was a year old. Another daughter and I'm a son, so I have a 20-year-old daughter and a 15-year-old son. My wife, which she did a fine art painting career. We met in school, art school, so she's had a fine art painting career from all of her time in America up until the past 5-6 years. She's now recognized as one of the greatest tattoo artists in the world, and she has her own private studio in Northeast Philadelphia. And she does fine art tattoos, not the stuff that I have. This is just everything I have is like related to something that I love, culture, like a musician or a movie or whatever. But she does all originals. So I'm going off on crazy tangents, I guess, but it's just art is my life. We're a family of my wife is an artist. I'm an artist.
So being in St. Petersburg must have afforded you the awesome opportunity of seeing the Pushkin and the Hermitage fine art collections. That must have been just an amazing thing to be able to study.
The Hermitage, much like the Versailles, is just an incredible work of art in itself. And then the collection is it's like the Louvre or the Met. I mean, it's just one of those world-class collections. Not just, it's amazing. But my favorite museum was the Russian museums, Russian State Museum. There's a statue of Pushkin by great Russian sculptor Mikhail Anikushin, who passed away while I was in Russia. And the collection is the collection of Russian Voroyable and all these. One of my favorite sculptors, a guy named Alexander Matveyev. His work is similar to my old, but I think more sophisticated. And my favorite painter besides Van Gogh is a fellow named Pavel Filonov. So I was really fascinated by the Russian State Museum. You know, they the same way that poets like Anna Akhmatova are famous. and their artistry, on the visual art side, there was that kind of stuff going on in the 19th century and early 20th century. You know, people have to understand abstract art, modern art, ostensibly was invented by Russia, right? With Malevich, who was Polish, but Malevich and Kandinsky and Tatlin and Pevsner, constructivism, you know, the beginnings, all the seeds of what became modern art kind of really began in Russia, which is kind of interesting, I think. But there was a freedom there. See, yeah, when I was there, you understand, like the communism had just fallen and it was all new to them. You know, this kind of, people were still very austere in the streets. They're not used to being publicly kind of demonstrative. More Russian folks, you're always welcome in somebody's home. You always bring a gift, like a bottle of wine, but nobody treats you more like family than, I'd never experienced anything like it. And it was the best, it was incredible. Everything I learned about sculpture, everything, I learned nothing in America except from my teacher, Leonid, another Russian guy named Leonid Brenner. Nothing I learned of value at any of the American institutions. I went to New York Academy, it was horrible. Philadelphia College of Art was full of good people, but it was a horrible school. Harvey Citron was my first real sculpture professor before I met Leonid Lerman. He was a great guy, but he was fighting an uphill battle. And realistically, everything that I do now is a product of everything I learned in Russia. While I'm working traditionally or digitally, I learned everything about relief in Russia. I learned everything about medallic sculpture in Russia. I learned everything about, I sculpted life-size figures in relief, in high relief, in low relief. I sculpted portraits. I did so much more extensive study of working from the model than they ever did or do here. It was an amazing experience. Basically, my school was really inspired by the aesthetic of a guy who worked with Rodin for 20 something years, but he has his own museum in Paris and monuments all over Europe. His name's Emile Antoine Bourdelle. And he became my favorite sculptor, and he's my favorite sculptor to this day. And I carry his work next to me as well. Just like Van Gogh. I carry my little Bourdelle book. I have a bunch of them here actually, but this one I got in Russia. But I think it's actually a Czech book.
So when you returned to America, I mean, what was your first sort of big break where you were actually, you know, making a living off of this and able to sort of advance your career?
I didn't get a big break, but I got a job. There's a I talked to my old teacher Harvey Citron, and he recommended I try and get a job at this place called the Johnson Atelier, which may exist or may not exist anymore. I was a fine art foundry owned by this Johnson & Johnson heir. He did these kind of like really horrid mannequin type, like fake slice of life type figures, and then sculptures based on impressionist paintings. And if you ever saw the that giant statue of the sailor kissing the nurse.
Oh, yeah.
That's the guy, right? And so I basically was his ghost sculptor, one of his ghost sculptors for 8 years. 3 years into it, they took away our traditional enlarging. Just like they used to use Janvier's to reduce coins, well, they used pantographs to enlarge sculptures, right? Going the wrong way. These pantographs to enlarge sculptures. One day they just came and took our pantograph out, and they said, you guys are done soon. We're going all digital. So I took it upon myself to learn as much as I could about digital stuff. Learn how to sculpt digitally every night in the office by myself working there. You could use the facility. So nights and weekends, I studied digital. I had this classical training. I had no ambition to be a digital guy. But then an opportunity to work at the Mint presented itself, and I applied. And they wanted, so historically, all designers and sculptors of the Mint were called sculptor engravers. I am the first ever medallic artist, meaning all the skills of a sculptor engraver plus being able to sculpt digitally. So I had to have classical and digital skill sets melded into one. And I got lucky enough to get the job. And I'm talking way too much during this thing. Sorry, Charlie.
No, it's fine. I mean, so how do you go from just, you know, taking it upon yourself to learn this technique to becoming, I guess, I mean, you're considered one of the world's leading digital sculptors now, I guess.
Oh, longest practicing, I'd say for
Longest
sure.
pricing. So I mean, like what sort of what were the what goes into working in a digital environment as opposed to a physical medium and
Nothing, man. Like the same way, look, I taught myself digitally the same way I learned traditional. I took plaster casts like this, smaller, whatever. I did old master copies and using 3D software that was available at the time. I just did old master copies and I taught myself how to do it. I didn't care about, I wasn't worried about the programs. I was worried about the form. And I didn't, I had a buddy from Ukraine that got a job making a ton of money doing video games. I didn't want to do that. I did apply to Lucasfilm. I got rejected. I applied to DreamWorks. I got rejected, and it didn't really bother me because I didn't want to make intangible stuff. I only wanted to do digital for sculpting, and we did that where I worked. You know, we would CNC and large sculptures and stuff like that. So, you know, but the pay was horrible. The treatment was horrible. Everything about that job was a nightmare. But it gifted me with the opportunity to learn digital for whatever reason. So I'm grateful to it. You know what I mean? It was a bridge, and other mints were doing digital coins using embossing software technology, and they all look flat, and they were flat, and you would see them. They just look like logos or this or that. I would I think I'm pretty sure the mint put me in a, now this technology was proved out here before I started. There was a team of technicians. And there was a guy who works as one of our product design specialists, which is essentially he's like an industrial designer, helps facilitate the manufacturability of the sculptures that people do. But Jay Kishwara worked as a contractor here, and he helped prove out the process before I came on board. But I used some different software too, and by 2000, so when I first came here, they weren't wouldn't let me sculpt digitally. The people, the part, not because there was still, even though they wanted to go in that direction, there was some trepidation. You know, they were still reducing things via the Janvier machine, and the milling, the CNC milling really wasn't quite there. So there was good reason for that, right? I did like eight models in clay and plaster the traditional way. I still have the very first, I should have brought it out. The very first thing I ever did was a practice Michelangelo copy. Like I just the same thing. Like I didn't know how to sculpt coins. I never sculpted a coin in my life. So I taught myself by copying a Michelangelo painting, a Sibyl from the Sistine ceiling. And when they finally gave me the chance to sculpt, I was doing digital restoration. I was like doing digital engineering, like the 2006 Gold Buffalo. I engineered that, like, you know, I scanned it and did this and did that. And we actually took Frazier's actual, I think the 2001 reprint, there were 2001 commemorative that used for. That was actually that was a reproduction, but there was a lot of manual work. Whereas the 2006 gold bullion was scanned from Frazier's original model. That was that's when we first started doing that. And along with the silver bullion obverse, the Wyman obverse was also around that time. We were dabbling, you know, trying to make it work. But the first actual, I think, fully sculpted digital portrait, probably in world history. It was a 2007 James Monroe presidential obverse, and that was cool because that was my design and my sculpt. I hate calling it sculpt because sculpt is really the infinitive of two, you know, first, but it's just become ubiquitous in the industry. Like people call a sculpture a sculpt, so I kind of got lazy like that. But then coming to the Mint, man, it changed my life. It was wonderful. I had my first year. I got more. I don't mean this in a, as a flex, but I had more design selected than all the other sculptor engravers, I think, put together. Two presidents. I was supposed to get all four first spouses, but it wasn't even really my bosses. But the John Mercanti, I think he felt that it would go to my head if I got all four, so he told headquarters to just give me three of them, and
Only
something
three.
like,
Yeah.
yeah, no. But I was blessed like that. It was like it's a gift. The mint is a gift. Everything that ever happens to me, the mint, I look at it as a gift. And it's evolved into something I never could have dreamed. I love this place with all my heart. It's the best thing that ever happened to me as an artist.
With your love of comics, have you ever thought about like, dabbling and, doing a do creating a comic for professionally just as a sort of a side hustle or?
No, when I was in grad school, I interviewed with DC Comics, and the editor said, you draw what you draw really well, but you don't know how to tell a story. He's like, would you like to try inking? And I'm like, I'm a penciler. He's like, would you like to? Because my dream, my idea was like going to sculpt all day and do comics at night, and that's not going to pay the bills. And so he was offering me a chance to become an inker, and I turned it down. I then got some practice work from a company called Valiant, and worked on it enough that they were going to accept me. Actually, I got in, but at that point, I already had my ticket for that first scouting trip to Russia, so my mind had been made up. See, I've always kind of tried to distance my two worlds, because I never wanted to become pigeonholed by the mint or the committees. This is as an artist, like, the advisory committees or anybody that might be exposed to what I do. I don't want to be pigeonholed as a comic guy or the Star Wars guy. It's not just, or the movie guy or, sci-fi guy. But at the same time, it's not just comics. I mean, I designed the conceptual model for the biggest statue in the history of the world. That's a pretty heavy duty fine art project. I mean, as a flex, I mean that like it's the biggest statue in the history of the world. And I was picked by the architecture firm because they couldn't figure out how to do it. There's a superstructure inside. There's actually a building inside of it. It's huge, like a 300 foot tall, 400 foot tall building. And they couldn't figure out how to work a figure around it. So they hired me to not only design the sculpture itself, but also engineer it so it actually could fit around this internal architectural model that they had as a CAD model. And then the guy that gets credit for the sculpture, he really kind of just sculpted the face. Because when I look at the actual sculpture itself, I can see that they actually use my digital model for the enlargement. But that's cool, man. I don't need credit for it. I know what I worked on it. I know it's. I've done some other stuff, with gallery shows and this and that. But but to come back to your question, so in two, when I start working for the Mint, opportunity to start doing some side work came up. And everything I do gets run by the Mint internally. So somebody says, hey, do you want to work for Hasbro? I said, sure, I'll give it a shot. So I started working on some stuff for them, did some stuff for the first Iron Man movie, learned how to make action figures. And then I started doing more work for a statue company called Bolin Designs. Did the first probably ever independently produced digital statue in the industry. There were companies making them. But then I had a chance to. I've worked for everybody from like DC Comics, Gentle Giant. I worked for every major statue company in the US over the past 18 years. And I still do work in the collectibles industry. Yeah, I mean, not, and it's not just to make money though. If you look at, I'm not going to compare myself to these people, although I do aspire to be the greatest chief engraver of all time. I truly do. I'm no equal to Sinnock or any of these other guys, right? But as a public servant, that should be nothing. My goal should be nothing short of that in order to serve the American people the right way, right? Like be the best.
Well, I
And
mean, they didn't have to create dozens of designs every year either, these guys.
yeah, but they had their own challenges, and they've forged the path that allowed us to be here today. But what I was going to say is, but all of them are sculptors. This whole like technocratic thing of becoming a medallic sculptor only, I think it dilutes the art form. It weakens it, because all the greatest medallic artists in history, in my opinion at least, going back to Pisanello and beyond, not coin, not the guys in, no, I'm not talking about Greek and Roman coins or coins from all over, but Medal for me, the alpha of what we do began with Pisanello, and he was a sculptor, not so much like, or even look at Cellini, who people think about like as a jewelry type guy, but historically, the best sculptors that ever served the nearest United States Mint were sculptors, and medallic art was part of their repertoire. They did relief. They did medals. They did portraits in the round. They did big sculptures. They did monuments. They were fully rounded, well-rounded sculptors. And all of that, see that all that in all that in activity together synthesizes and informs each, all those different facets of the discipline of sculpture inform each other. And I don't think one can be a good relief sculptor without being a good 3D sculptor within the Western tradition. I think it's necessary to have. So by having this all this experience on the side sculpting these figures for the collectible industry, I'm sculpting, even though it's digital, I never feel like I'm doing anything other than, you know, I went to school for 10 years straight. And all that's in my head all the time. And all that experience working from the live, I spent thousands of hours in front of live models. I've done over 100 life-size figures at the foundry, portraits. I've worked on 20-foot tall statues and by hand. I've done so much work traditionally over the years. Even when I'm working in software, I engage it as if it's physical. I never think about it as software. I just think about it as form, you know, weight, balance, mass, construction, all this stuff. Same thing for me, sculpting relief in software. It's like it was immediately like second nature. It's no big deal. I don't mean it's not a big, I don't mean what we do is, of course, everything the Mint makes is a big deal, but I mean like, and I think because I grew up with Atari and Intellivision and all that stuff, like computers, like the video language, it never felt threatening to me. I stopped using the computers around the time, like the first, I don't know, what was it? The first Macintosh, they called it, you know, the first Mac. Remember that? Right. I hadn't used computers. I stopped using computers like from like, I don't know, 1988, 89. I didn't pick one up. Like, I didn't get my own computer again until 1998 when I first got back from Russia. It was a used one from my mom. And I had no interest in it, but even at the foundry, I was learning it, but I hated it in the beginning. I didn't hate it. I just hated the idea of becoming a commercial sculptor. I just couldn't. I did a lot of fine art, stuff those 8 years. I mean, it did. I'm finally now just getting my own studio back together after 18 years of being here. I lost my big studio that I had. One thing that was cool is they gave us free studio space. But, but the Mint satisfied that kind of imperative that I had to like follow along and try and contribute to a tradition. So then anything I did on the side was just for me and it was just fun, you know. Yeah, I was doing it for money, but I had a good time working on every, I'm doing Star Wars and superheroes and all kinds of Harry Potter and sculpting stuff like that. And I'm not going to, it was fun. And then going to Comic-Con and I used to go to San Diego Comic-Con. I still do go. I don't know if I'm going this year because I might go somewhere else. But I got to be part of a much larger community. And I think for a while, my profile outside the Mint was way more pronounced than it was in the Mint. Like I really enjoyed a lot of, I've been very lucky in developing a pretty, it's just a good community out there to be a part of. And I met a lot of artists that I idolized ever since I was a kid. And it's just been embraced by that community since day one. And that community is suffering some hardships right now because of not just the pandemic, but cargo container crisis. There's a whole bunch of things affecting the collectibles industry right now, but once I became chief engraver, that's the only thing that mattered to me. And then it totally eclipsed doing the side work. The side work went from being like a financial imperative, which I still need. Don't get me wrong. I'm very fortunate. Make a good salary, but I still need to do side work to support my family. But it's almost like now it's like cathartic when I'm sculpting on the weekends. Like, you know, I only do my side work on the weekends. And when I do, it's like, it's relaxing. It's because being chief engraver requires my full attention. And for me, it's a 24/7 thing. I'm never not thinking about this job, not thinking about how to improve, not thinking about other things we could do to improve as a team, as an organization, and as much as I get to have input in bigger ideas besides my department. But
so being chief engraver is a bit. Yeah, what would you say then is different about being a chief engraver than just being one of the more senior engravers on the staff?
The cool thing about being chief engraver is you get to have art directorial. You get to exercise. I get it's like you get to be the conductor of the artistic symphony, both of the internal artists and the AIP artists, and you get to contribute ideas about what the values, artistic values of the place should be, and I get to contribute, and then I get gifted with magical programs like before, and the first thing as I became chief engraver, like, hey, let's have you sculpt the Platinum Series, the Donna Weaver design. And then I get, you know, you saw it's public now, the Royal Mint collaboration, which is for me the most important thing I've done in my life to date. Everything I do with the Mint matters, don't equally, but the Mint gifts me with, like, getting to do Director Ryder's medal. That was great, you know, like, so I get to do these solo projects, and I still do the compete with the other folks, but my ambitions as a designer are changing dramatically. Because I'm chief engraver and I get to do these independent projects, I can kind of, like, I'm starting to realize, I only just realized like a couple weeks ago, that this entire time I've been designing coins the way I think coins should look. I've been engaging my classical skills and all that stuff almost exclusively because I was afraid to be perceived as something substandard or like as if pop culture is evil. And now I'm like, why am I doing this? I mean, why don't I'm 52 years, 52. I'm going to be 53 years old in 11 days. So I'm like, I got to start just being me. So I figure I want to start making designs that maybe, not that I wouldn't want them to be competitive or get selected by the advisory board, not or be selected by the secretary, you know, liked by the advisory boards, but maybe I start designs that are more out there to try and, you know, stretch the rubber band. So when it snaps back, it's maybe not as, maybe it's a little further ahead than where it was. I think I can use this, you know, other artists, there's more of an imperative to get design selected. I'm not saying it's not my responsibility to, but because I get gifted with these special projects like Royal Mint or this or that, when I just jump on a program, I can afford to be, I think, a little more adventuresome. And it's only something I really discovered this past week that this is what I want to start doing. Like really just, I'm not saying like make Bugs Bunny cartoons, you know, like, I mean, nothing that would be unworthy of the United States Mint, but maybe I really want to move the needle. You know,
well, let me ask this question then. I mean, what would you say are like the elements of a good coin design? I mean, in your view?
Well, if you listen to the public meetings, I think it was former chairperson Mary Lannan, the CCSC, called it the tabletop test. And I just my test is like, you know, arm's length. If I'm able to see it and it looks cool, that's the first important thing. Because where does change land? You get it at the convenience store or whatever, and it's on the counter, right? So it should be able to catch your eye from whatever, from a reasonable distance. But in terms of what's good, I don't have a prescription for that, you know? I mean, I do think, without trying to be pejorative, I think, we should be moving forward to a place where we're not just reproducing the greatest coins in history, but we're actually making the greatest coins in history, that we're able to generate a new golden age of American coinage. And I believe it's going to happen. And I believe everyone's done a great job so far, everybody on the team inside and out historically. I think under the leadership, I won't say the Mint ever done. I would just say we weren't at our best in say the 60s and 70s and even 80s, but with the beginning of the Artistic Infusion Program, and which was something that forced internal Mint artists to become more nimble. And a little more hungry, not hungry, but yeah, because once there's competition, it made people get more Because I came in like 2 years, I think, after the AIP program started. So, you know, it was pretty competitive, and it was exciting, you know, and it forced everybody to up their game in the same way that I think our current call for artists could prove to be something very special. Once it's concluded, pending the quality of the applicants, of which I have no foreknowledge of it, that I don't even know when it ends, and I don't know what the final vetting process is going to be, but I'm sure whatever we get in the end is going to be probably unlike anything we've ever had before. In the kind of personal interest I've heard expressed about it by certain kinds of artists, I encourage every professional American artist to apply. There's still time left. Maybe not by the time the podcast is out. I think it might end on the 10th. I'm not sure. But yeah, you know, we're doing a call out to we're doing a call for artists that I think could yield just enhance the roster, you know, like another batch of first round draft picks, basically. I'm not a sports guy, but I used to be a huge football guy, so I still use football analogies. You know, it's like we have a bunch of starters in place, but if we get a whole nother batch of first round draft picks, and then, you know, there is no bench. I mean, if we have if there's infinite depth of our bench, I always look at it like this, like a coin design is not a competition. I look at every coin design in the portfolio as being, I try and support each one as a winner when I'm art directing. And I look at our corporate effort as a team of artists inside and out, you know, AIP and Medallic artists, is we're like a team. They're trying to advance the ball down the field. And whatever design winds up being selected by the secretary, that's that last person was able to just get it, you know, just make that fourth and goal and just get the ball across the goal line. It's a corporate effort, though. We all inspire each other. We all motivate each other. I don't really look at it as a competition. For me, as chief of grader, I have to see it as a team effort. You know, I don't have favorites. I fail a lot. I've made a lot of mistakes as the art director. I've hurt people's feelings inadvertently, and I've stumbled a lot along the way. And I've stumbled a lot as chief engraver, frankly. I've made a, you know, going from artist to art director, that wasn't such a big shift, because I just pulled out I just pulled down the then 14 years of being art directed on the outside. I'm used to being art directed. So I brought that, because we were never really art directed in the past. Like, it was more just like, you know, the people that came before me, whether they were lead sculptors or art, or called chief engravers or whatever. And I don't mean whatever, because when I first came on board, I was actually hired by the head at dye shop. I wasn't hired by, you know, we were part of the dye shop. It was a totally different structure than we have now. I'm very fortunate to have Mike Costello as my boss. He's the head of design and engraving, the best guy I ever worked for. Gives me the liberty to be crazy and do all my artistic BS, and he trusts me, which is I can't thank him enough for. And Director Gibson and Director Ryder, I'll thank him till the day I'm dead, because he resurrected the chief engraver position, and he was a great friend and mentor to me. And Director Gibson is an absolute blessing to the Mint, and she's been really amazing to me as well. I don't know, this chief engraver thing, it's like, not to use a comp, I'm like the, you know, I get to be like, it's like being the Stan Lee of the coin world. You know what I mean? Like, coin community thinks it's cool. I'm kind of like the unofficial mascot of the Mint. You know what I mean? Like, chief engraver, I mean, it's an historic position. It puts me in a weird spot. It's very, you know, it's different. Talking too much. I'm sorry.
No. Speaking about chief engraver, I mean, you must be aware. I'm pretty sure you are. You know, there's 13 individuals who've been the chief engraver of the United States Mint since its founding, and pretty much every coin collector can name every single one of them. I mean, do you ever find yourself, you know, doing any like study of any of these different guys and like what they were about, or having anything you take away from some of their old work? And I hear what you're saying about the Mint Putting the Mint in a position where they're creating a new golden age, which I'm totally in favor of. There is this weight of history, I think, that comes with the position.
I don't know. My thing is, like, I don't think about that kind of stuff. I think about how do we – American Women Quarters is actually a great start for this. It's not my idea. This is legislated. But I think coins should serve as like little mirrors that all Americans can see themselves reflected in. All Americans, regardless of whatever community they come from, whatever political position they come from. Our job as public servants is to serve the country fully, every single American. And so I'm more interested in that than thinking about the past. You know, I'm more interested in how can the Mint, and, you know, I'm not, so much depends on legislation, but even in the way you choose to represent a subject, like, does it have to be in the same kind of old, like, traditional Western style, or can you engage artists that have different styles to be authentically themselves and represent these things that are still recognizable as whatever they're supposed to be, but are different? You know, I mean, I think we're the greatest mint in the world. We're the greatest mint in history, frankly. And I honestly believe that. It means a lot to me. Means a lot to me to be the Philadelphia Mint, the first in. You know, this is the Alpha Mint, all the master tooling's made here in our division. We make between me, my boss, Mike Costello, and my friend, Matt Hill, who's now, Mike Costello used to be the head of engraving, but now it's a guy named Matthew Hill, and he's fantastic. The three of us are responsible for creating all master tooling models and tooling for all the mints. That's everything from sculptures, sculpted models to date changes. I'm proud of that. That's Philly, right? So the first thing I did when I became chief engraver is I bought this statue and I put it at the highest spot in my office because I could see Philly behind me. And it means a lot to me. It's not some like novel, like just joke thing. Like I'm from this area. My parents were born in Philadelphia. I'm very proud to be part of the Philadelphia Mint. And I'm proud of all the mints. I think we have, this is the best batch of superintendents I've ever been able to, now that I'm chief engraver, I get to meet these folks on a different level, go to meetings and stuff like that. I think it's the best the mint's ever been. And I think we're about to enter I think Director Gibson has a, I won't speak on any way and for her, on her behalf, but I would call her visionary and inspiring. And this is not for job security. This is,
I met her at the ANA last summer and we got to sit with her and she was extraordinary. Absolutely extraordinary. She seemed like the type of individual who definitely knew what she was doing in a leadership role and would go to bat for her staff. Like she was remarkable.
The difference from every other person I've witnessed, from whatever vantage point I had, I've only been in this position 4 years. I've been here 18 years almost. So for most of my career, being chief engraver, you kind of get access, like it gives you access to certain things in a special way, which is a gift. And so I'm able to interact with headquarters in a different way and stuff like that. I'm no big deal. I'm just a frontline supervisor, right? I mean, but they still, I get, the chief engraver is it's cool. I think it's the coolest job in the Mint. I selfishly would say that. But I never saw anybody like her come in and just learn and learn and learn and absorb and learn. So many other leaders have come in acting or deputies or whatever and just gone right into the big office and start bossing people around and making decisions. But Director Gibson is very, like a general. She plans, you know, she think twice, lift once kind of director. You know, that's one thing. When I used to work at the foundry, I also worked in the installation crew a lot. And that was one of the things the supervisor would say, think twice, lift once, you know, because it's like when you're moving something that's like 5,000 pounds with a crane, you don't want to have to do it again. And Director Gibson is very much a thoughtful but a thoughtful but active director. And I think we're really lucky to have her.
Well, Joe, thank you so much for taking the time out. We look forward to seeing the next several years of amazing art from the U.S. Mint.
Thank you for supporting. Thank you and all the Coin Press, Coin Week, and your colleagues out there for supporting us, what we do, because the United States Mint is the oldest art-driven institution in our nation. Coins are one of the oldest art forms in world history, and they are enduring and they're important. And I think you're going to see going forward a big push, a successful push by the Mint to make coins even more relevant than they have been in recent years. And we can't do it without you guys out there. So really appreciate it. Thank you.
Well, have a great rest of your week, Joe. Thank you so much.